Ladies and gentlemen, if I can have your attention,
you have a lot of friends.
Can ask you to start taking
your
seats.
Or people find your story interesting.
We'll get going in just a minute.
Remember, be expansive.
My name is Paul Yock. I'd like to welcome you on behalf of the program in Biodesign. We have a terrific evening this evening, and actually it's personally satisfying for me to see Hira Thapliyal up here, who was a major reason that I got involved in medical technologies in the first place. So, the start of a long-term friendship. So it's particularly nice. I want to say a couple of things before we start the formal program. One is, if you could please turn off your cell phones. We're making an audio recording of this. Second, I want to mention that there'll be a reception at the end. So please stick around for that and have a chance to say hi to Hira. Third thing is that we will have questions at the end of the session, so think up questions and please use a microphone for those. I want to make sure to thank Casey McGlynn from Wilson Sonsini and Tracy Lefteroff from PricewaterhouseCoopers, who are sponsors for this evening. And then David Kasich from Wendover, who is doing the interview and donating his time, and you'll see the write-up from this interview in vivo sometime pretty soon. So I think that with no further ado, we'll start.
Great, thank you, Paul. Can you hear me in the back of the room? Great. Well, you know, for those of you who've been to several of these, and I'm blanking on how many years we've been doing this, it's gotta be 6 or 7 years now. With Hira today, we kind of return to part of the original vision of this, which was to go back to some of the early entrepreneurs and early inventors who played a critical role. And as you hear more about Hira's story, you'll see that he played a very critical role in the early days of interventional cardiology, formulating companies that developed some of those interesting technology, and then actually has just followed that up and is now in one of the most challenging spaces, atrial fib, which we'll get to a little bit later. But before we even get to the early days in interventional cardiology, you came to the U.S. about 40 years ago this year. Give us a little bit of your early schooling here and how that led to your first entry into industry.
Well, I came here in 69, went to Washington State University and got a degree in EE, electrical engineering, then went next door to University of Idaho in Moscow and got a master's degree in EE, then went to Cornell in material science and engineering. Then I joined Corning Glassworks. And as it didn't happen that one day I was sitting and I said, oh, one day there was going to be a innovator's workbench and what do I have to do to get in there? So it didn't quite happen that way. It's just when I showed up at Corning, they pointed me to a program and they said, thou shalt work on this, which happened to be a medical device. It was a glass scalpel. Which was, edges were heated with a thin film, and then when you cut with the scalpel, it would cauterize. A terrific product, but that's how I got started in medical device. Also, my lesson number one there was that you have to make it for a reasonable cost. The device worked very well, but it was very expensive to make, so there was really no market for it.
Did Corning have a medical device business, or was it a Skunk Works project? What was the... You had the technology to, and it should be pointed out that it was the same material used in some of the rocket reentry vehicles. But what was Corning's intention with that product?
Corning had a medical device division at that time, and they had a number of products out on the market. So it was in their surgery division, actually, that this product was being developed. And it was in collaboration with a California company called Oximetrix.
So we'll get to Oximetrics in a second. So when I got off the airplane today, it was 75 degrees. And if you come from California, you don't know what winters on the East Coast are like. But Corning is smacking that snow belt in upstate New York. How did you get out here, and why did you come out here?
Oh, well, yeah, I had been in upper United States for 12 years. And then all the elements of the weather and everything I had seen. Then one spring day in Corning, it had rained, and it froze in the night. Next morning when I came out of my apartment, I slipped, fell, and broke my collarbone. So I said, I'm going to California. That does it for me. So I packed my belongings in the car, and I drove across the country and ended up here in Sunnyvale. And my thought was that I have degrees in electrical engineering and material science. I should be in the semiconductor industry. And I joined a company called Amdahl Corporation. And Amdahl was Gene Amdahl, who had pioneered System 370, the biggest computer at IBM. And then he was looking to start his own company at that time, which was Trilogy. And a lot of people from Amdahl moved to Trilogy. So I was there for about a year. And that was my lesson number two there, that very quickly there were 500 people in the company from 700 different organizations. So the corporate culture did not gel. Different groups were doing things from where they came from. And so it began to look like that this was not going to make it. Interestingly, not for the reasons of technology, which was terrific, but how the organization came together. So meanwhile, my heart remained in medical devices. So I came back and I joined Oxymetrics, actually, at that time. And I worked for John Moroney. He was my boss at Oxymetrics.
And what was Oxymetrics?
Oxymetrics was a company that made three products. One was, a version of that scalpel. And one was, the main product was the IV pump. And then there was a oximeter that would sense the blood oxygen level in the heart.
And there was a connection with Corning. They had a contract with Corning, but was it an independent standalone organization, or was it a division of
Corning? No, Oxymetrics was an independent company. Interestingly, started by Dr. Shaw. Some of you may be familiar with Dr. Shaw's name. Then later, it was sold to Abbott. So now it's a division of Abbott.
And what did you do for Oxymetric?
I was in charge of process engineering. And I still haven't figured out what that is. But my job was to make sure all the processes run smoothly and product that comes out of it meets all the specs and requirements and everything. So I was in charge of all the processes for these three products lines at Oxymetric.
So I think what we would deem to be the kind of formative, the first major step was your participation in DVI. How did you meet John Simpson? Tell us how the DVI story got started.
Yeah, so one Sunday morning, as a dumb bachelor, I was working at Oxymetrics. I looked outside, a beautiful day. I said, no, I'm working too hard. I should be in a startup or something. This is not right. So I started looking around, and through some common friends, I heard of Dr. John Simpson. And I set up an interview and went to meet with him. And he had his office on Welch Road next to Stanford. So I went there, and there was this young man sitting behind the desk. And I almost asked him, I'm here to, would you tell me where I can find Dr. Simpson? But then I saw his label name, which said John Simpson, MD. And I did a double take. And by that time, John had a degree in agricultural engineering from Ohio State, then a master's and a PhD, then an MD from Duke, practiced, pioneered the balloon angioplasty, started a company, ACS, sold it to Lilly, and he had just turned 40. I said, that's the person I want to be with. So it was very fortunate for me that John gave me a job, and then I came on. DVI had been founded, and sometimes people call me a co-founder of DVI, but that's not really true. There's only one founder of DVI. That's John.
Did you know anything about interventional cardiology? Was there anything in your background that made a natural connection to what DVI was doing?
No, my extent of knowledge was I knew what a catheter is. That's about it. Then I had heard there is something called PTCA, and I worked very hard to have those words, percutaneous, transluminal, coronary angioplasty. And three of the four names I did not know. Only thing I knew was coronary. But I still said something to John, must have impressed him. But it was a real fascinating project that you devise a cutting mechanism that will be placed inside of the artery, and then you, it was a spinning cup-shaped cutter that would cut the plaque and collect it distally in a cup, and then you do these shavings, clean out the artery. And I was able to put together a group of local vendor network that I knew who would do different elements of that product. And we were able to develop it fairly quickly.
But your background had been in not only process engineering, but a lot of packaging. How did you get up to speed on the kind of sophisticated cutting technology that would be required for DVI? Were there a lot of stops and starts in DVI's early technology development, or did it kind of flow naturally?
There were stops and starts, and the important thing that I believe in philosophically is that quick iterations is key. You don't sit on one thing for a long time. You just iterate very quickly. So you need very efficient vendor network, good machinists, machine shops, tubings, the irradiation, balloon making, braiding, and all that. So I was able to put it together very quickly, and we were iterating fast.
I think one of the interesting things about Hira's career is that, particularly on the technology side, it wasn't as if he went back and was reinventing or going back to the same thing you'd done at earlier stages, but you kept finding new technology challenges. And the reason why I raised it that way is because you were at DVI till about 1986, and then left to be one of the then you ran into another young cardiologist, shall we say who?
Yes, we can.
Paul Yock.
Right.
And that was the beginning of CVI. Talk about that. And again, here's a technology ultrasound that you didn't have a background in.
Correct. I did not know ultrasound. But Paul was, earlier he tried to blame me for all this, but for what he has done, remarkable achievements. But Paul was a young fellow at Stanford, and one day John came to me. He said, you know, there is this very bright young man, and he has this crazy idea about using ultrasound on this spinning cutter and to do imaging at the same time of inside of the arteries. Do you think you could work with him? I said, sure, I'll try. And then Paul came over, and this idea looked so exciting. And it happens in companies that the project became quickly seductively defocusing. So instead of working on the cutting atherectomy device, we were working on Paul's device. It seemed a little more exciting. So the board of DVI decided to spin it out of there. And then Paul, myself, and John Simpson founded Cevas back in 86.
Now, when you first joined Cevas, or when Cevas was first launched, what role did you play?
Well, I was the chief bottle washer there. With good gracious of Paul and John. And then we brought in a very smart young person, Dr. Jim Aronson. He's here in the audience. He had done his PhD in ultrasound. I said, oh, now we have an expert. So we brought him on board, and he very quickly modified an existing system and got us going. Initially, we would do imaging on something called a phantom, which is like a harpsichord, and you sweep the ultrasound by it, and if you can pick up these fish lines onto the screen, that means you're doing something good. Mm-hmm. Then later, our very first artery experiment was in Norway, and Paul and I went there, and Paul was so proud of this picture on the screen, and I looked at it, and I said, there's got to be a focus knob here somewhere. So even today, the ultrasound images look like that to me, that the focus knob is missing. At any rate, then we very quickly moved into, and we had a terrific board. We had Dick Kramlich from NEA, Dr. Fogarty himself, and Paul and John, and they were terrific guidance in the early days to somebody who didn't know anything.
So you, at some point, became CEO of CVIS. How did that come about?
That was from day one.
From day one, you were the CEO?
Yeah. When I went to Casey, he said, where do I sign? He said, you are the CEO. Sign here. So I did.
So as CEO, you had to worry about more things than just the technology challenge. Talk about some of the early adoption issues around ultrasound. You yourself said it looked like a fuzzy, defocused issue. What was it like introducing intravascular ultrasound into the clinical community?
Well, my role went up to the point where we submitted the application to the FDA for an IDE approval. So we got the IDE approval, and that's when I handed over to the next CEO. What had happened was that in 86, I had gotten married, and my wife is here in the audience, and then my son was born. So I decided to take a year off, and that's what I did. I left CBiz, be home, and changed diapers, cooked meals, and it was fun.
So I know that
I did not get into the marketing aspects of the ultrasound.
When we get to Arthrocare, I know that the transition, the handoff was a big issue. How difficult an issue was it to hand over the company to the new CEO? And that CEO didn't do well. It wasn't until Rich Ferrari came on that Cevas took off. What was going on at Cevas in those early days?
Well, this was a gentleman, he had his training at Baxter. Perfectly qualified fellow, but somewhat mercurial. So, and that is really a dangerous thing. It's fortunate that Rich came on board and he rescued the company, Rich Ferrari. But he had a style where he didn't recognize that the ship was getting bigger and bigger. And then he would want to turn it on a dime and expect it to happen. And that created tremendous dislocations in the company. And one day, the rest of the management team said, no, not with this fellow. So he had to be let go.
And where did you find Rich Ferrari? Where did Rich come from?
Well, I think he was roaming on the street somewhere. We I don't know. Paul, maybe you can shed some light on that a little later. Yeah.
So you took a year off to change diapers for a year.
Right.
I can't imagine that you're tired of that after a year.
No, I did it again when my daughter was born. And she's here.
So in 1989, you launched another company. And this was actually one that didn't work out. DVI
Correct.
And Cevas were two actually legendary. But talk about microbionics, what it was intended to do, how the idea came to you, and why didn't that one work out?
All right. Yeah, DVI was sold to Lilly again. And Cevas went public and then was sold to Boston Scientific. Microbionics was an effort at SRI, Stanford Research Institute, to do indwelling blood gas monitoring. There would be a little catheter which would go in the radial artery, and for 3 days in ICU, it will monitor blood gases. Terrific idea. And it was really the existing monitors miniaturized on a silicon chip and then packaged in a small needle. And product worked great as long as you didn't have to use it in blood. There's a little shortcoming. And we did a fair amount of testing on it, but blood is a very complex substance. And for 3 days, something to sit there and faithfully give you data, it just wasn't happening.
So you left in 92, did you shut the company down at that point, or did you just leave and the company ran for a little
company longer? Was under a venture fund called Comtech International. So they tried to keep it going. Meanwhile, back in 87, a colleague of mine, Phil Eggers, and I started looking into chronic total occlusions. So we started filing some patents, so I decided to pursue that.
Just before we get to, because that's going to lead us into Arthrocare, which actually began with a different name. Talk about microbionics in the sense that you talked about learning lessons at Corning and at Amdahl. What lessons did you learn from microbionics? I mean, what was your takeaway from there?
My takeaway is don't be seduced by just technology. There are other aspects to making a business. And it was terrific technology coming out of SRI, except I didn't realize when I committed to it that $500 million had been already spent by everybody, Abbott, 3M, Baxter, trying to get this blood gas product going. And I thought I could do it. I mean, that was a bit too much. So in hindsight, you really need to be humble about what you're looking at and see if it can be indeed done or not.
Go back and tell us how you knew Phil Eggers, because he's actually out of Columbus, Ohio. He's not out of the Bay Area. Right. How did you get to know him? And then the company that you formed, actually, you say, was a CTO crossing company called AngioCare.
That's correct. Yeah, Phil was a consultant to Corning, actually. So I met him back in 78. And then through the years, I kept in touch with him. So when I was working on the DVI product, we would get these pieces of arteries from Stanford Morgue, and then I would position the device inside it and do the cutting. Frequently, these arteries were totally occluded. And I would then force a wire in there somehow and then put the DVI device. So I said, there's got to be a way to deal with these total occlusions. So I talked with Phil, and we came up with an idea of passing electrical current through the plaque, and thereby just warm it up, soften it, so you can advance a balloon with a wire, guide wire on it. And that was the genesis of the idea.
So did it work?
Actually, it kind of worked, but not really. So next step was to raise some money for it. So I went and visited some VCs, and my friend Sam Colella. So I went to Sam. And Sam was very polite. At least he let me into the door. And I described the project. He listened carefully. And then a few days later, he called back. He says, you know, Hira, this neat idea. We like you, but really, there's not a huge big market for it. Only 50,000 cases we envision being done, and you just cannot make a business out of it. So if you do something else, let me know. We might look at it. So that was it. I was, by that time, I've learned enough to listen to these kind of messages. Mm-hmm. So we started looking for something else.
So you then met two folks, Bob Garvian and Tony Manlove, and that led to the repositioning of AngioCare as ArthroCare. Tell us that story.
Right. Now, Tony Manlove used to be the president of Oximetrics. So Phil and I knew him from there. And then Bob Garvey was a fellow in arthroscopy business. His company was making these disposable arthroscopes in Reno. So Phil knew him from some time ago. So we met Bob, and he says, you know, we are making these scopes. We can go inside the knee. We don't have a tool then to do something. So we need a therapeutic tool. Do you think your technology would work? So Phil and I looked at each other, and I said, what tissues do we need to work on? He says, oh, this is called a meniscus, which is the gasket in the joint. Phil and I looked at each other and said, Phil, do you know what a meniscus is? I have no idea. So anyway, we went to the local grocery store, found a chicken leg, and pulled out the meniscus out of there, and tried our device, and amazingly, it worked great. It removed the tissue very quickly, no charring, no nothing. And it was truly serendipity, because we did not know certain things about arthroscopy. In fact, anything about it. So conventionally, electrosurgery used at a very high voltage. And it is contraindicated in saline solution. But we knew that they flush saline in the joint. So we set up a bath with saline in there, with the chicken meniscus, with two pins. And we started cranking up the voltage on our homemade computer. And at 1/10 the voltage, this phenomena started happening, which was later turned out is a plasma liquid ion, ionized sodium ions, which are breaking the hydrocarbon bonds and removing the tissue very efficiently. We discovered that later, had some patents on it. But it was truly total ignorance, which otherwise we would have gone to very high voltage where there are sparks and fireworks, literally.
At DVI, you were pursuing a revascularization strategy, but it was a novel approach, a novel technology.
Correct.
At Sevis, that was a completely novel technology. But there were lots of other arthroscopy companies and approaches to arthroscopy when ArthroCare was launched. How did you get around the issue of competing? For the first time, you were developing a competing technology in a fairly crowded space against some very large companies. Was that how much of a challenge was that for Arthrocare in the early days?
Yeah, that was pretty formidable indeed. That in arthroscopy, the conventional, it's amazing how the difference between cardiologist and orthopedic people. Right. Cardiologist, very delicate, very polite with each other, respectful. But the orthopods are like carpenters. They have these tools and mechanical things. So their whole tool set was mechanical instruments, these budding devices and operators and all that. And we come in with this delicate electrosurgical tool. So what we ended up doing, fortunately, was that we replaced about a dozen of their tools with one of ours. We could remove tissue, clean the bone, all that very quickly and very efficiently. So when we would show this product to the surgeons, orthopods, they would instinctively take on to it. And that made our job a lot easier.
But although I would say that one other difference between cardiologists and interventionalists was the appetite for new technology. I mean, DVI and CVIS were all companies launched within the first decade of the first balloon angioplasty procedure, whereas orthopedic surgeons tend, by reputation, to be very conservative. They've been doing these procedures a long time. They tend not to like to change. Didn't you find a conservative reaction among surgeons who might have said, it looks good, but you know, I know what I'm doing. I've been doing this for a long time. I like what I'm doing.
Yeah, we heard that initially. But what was favorable to us was take a case of, say, this thing called shoulder subacromial decompression. They got to have fancy names for
right.
these procedures. So what it is that you remove soft tissue from end of the bone, which is encroaching on the cuff. Mm-hmm. And it ordinarily takes about an hour and a half to remove it. It's bloody, and the tool changes this, that. When we did it in 15 minutes, mm-hmm. very clean. So that, with allegiance to any, that drew attention. And that thing became a quick adaptation in the marketplace with the shoulder procedure.
So Arthrocare was unique in your career for a number of things. For one thing, it was the company where you stayed the longest.
Correct.
You ran it from 1992 to 1997. How, when, why did you decide that it was time to step down in 1997?
Okay. Now, I just wanted to go back. I gave an incomplete answer.
Sure.
When we switched from Angiocare to Arthrocare, we looked at the market. By that, I learned that you got to look at the market, too, in addition to technology. So remember that Sam had told me that there would be 50,000 cases on CTO. We looked at arthroscopy in those days, back in 92, 93, they were doing 10,000 cases a day. So, whoa, this is interesting.
Yeah.
So even though our margins would be lower, the numbers were higher. So we did a spelling change from Angiocare to Arthrocare. And then Annette Campbell-White from MedVenture, she invested first chunk of money, and then we had InterWest and Sam from
IVP
came in, and then we went public. So all that came along pretty quickly in succession. But again, the thing was to very iterative at the thing. Lots and lots of animal studies, and that is, I believe, is what got us going. So the early phase, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So to coming to your question then, what made me stay long and
yeah.
got forward, is the early, I enjoy the early phase when it's innovative, you get to try all kinds of things, and I like to live in bliss of ignorance as long as I can. And that is really joyful. And then slowly things begin to get complex. Now we have marketing people, we have RAQA people, and pretty soon it's now a real business. And that's where I begin to say maybe there are other people who can do a better job.
So you were what was behind the decision to go public? Because you were also the CEO suddenly of a public company. How did that change? Because you had worked for all these privately backed startups in very early stages of technology. Now you are a more mature company, public in 1996. How did that change how, just your view, your perspective on running Arthrocare?
We did four BC rounds before deciding to go public. So going public for us was not so much a liquidity event, but to raise next round of money. And back in 96, then companies had started going public, and you could raise a fair amount of money for not much dilution. So that was our motivation. But I had no idea what going public means. So here I was a technology guy, and I remember one incident. In fact, I was in New York, and there was this financial news network. CNN had started this to compete with CNBC. And they invited me to be one of the guests when we were doing our investor meetings in New York. And it was a sudden invitation. So I called back home. We talked with our investor relations guru. And she said, oh, make sure you wear a blue shirt. Looks good on TV. I said, anything else? She said, no, that'll do it. So on this taxi ride from the hotel to the CNN studios, I was practicing my thing, you know, great technology, this is how we discovered it, and so on and so forth. So I show up, they did all the makeup, and I had my corporate standard white shirt here. I didn't have time to get the blue shirt. So then the fellow and I were talking, chit-chat, and suddenly this red light came. And he switched to his official voice, said, so, Dr. Thapliyal, when is your company going to be profitable? I said, holy smokes. And that's not what I said, but that's what it's all about. I mean, one of these days, you've got to bring returns to the investors in addition to helping the patients. So then the interview went downhill from there.
So, what was your answer?
I don't know what I said, but it's on a tape, and you
tried to get every copy you could.
That tape is sequestered, safe. Yeah. No, nobody will ever see it. But on the flight home, I decided maybe time has come to bring on a professional CEO here. So I called a meeting of the board, and I said time has come. So it took us a year. This was in summer of '96. 4 months after we had gone public.
Why did it take a year? Was there any particular reason? Because you wound up actually with a great CEO, Mike Baker.
Yeah, we went through 11 candidates. We went through a search firm, and you know, on the average, 1 month per candidate. By the time you do rounds of interviews, the board meets with the candidates and check them out and so forth.
So you stayed on for a year as the chief technology officer. You told me you wanted to make sure the handover was right. Was it difficult for you now not to always be looking over Mike Baker's shoulder, not to be telling him what he ought to be doing, or were you glad to turn this over to someone else?
By that time, I had recognized my nature, that I like to hand over. Alan Will at DVI, Chip Jennings at CBiz, and then now I was mentally prepared. So when Mike took over, and he was an ex-military guy, he really took over, and I felt good. I said, I don't need to worry about things. And we had two new products being developed, so I focused on those next generation products. Which, interestingly, there's a little anecdote about that. Is we just as we were to roll out the product, I called all 16 people in the room, and I said, let's do one thing. Tomorrow we're going to roll it out. And actually, it was in Toronto at one of these arthroscopy shows. So let's take a pot shot on our product. If you were somebody else, what would you say about our product? And obviously, everybody was very polite. Oh, there's nothing wrong with it. This is the best thing since sliced bread. So slowly, people began to open up. And then I had the sense of announcing a prize, that whoever gets the best thing will win something. So this young lady, she said, you know, our product is too wimpy. Sometimes it doesn't have enough oomph to it. So next morning, we started a program to put some oomph into the product. And that's the one I saw through in that following year. Yeah, made sure we delivered the
So this was this was the iteration beyond the original wand device?
Yeah.
So just before we get on to the next thing, because after 1997, you went through a little retirement again. Do you have a perspective? ArthurCare has been a great company. It's been, but it's hit a wall right now, and it's going through very difficult times. You may be a little constrained in what you can say, but do you have a perspective on what Arthur Kerr is going through right now?
Yeah, there are a couple of, three in fact, investigations going on right now. So probably wise for me not to say a whole lot. I don't know a whole lot to begin with, but still. But I thought of different ways of answering this question, and here is one way that one day I think I'm going to write a book. And I just added a chapter called How to Screw Up Things. And I'm taking case history solicitation. Anybody, any ideas, we'll put it in there. It just keep things simple. Do not try to get too fancy about things. You're going to get caught. And there's plenty to do. Fortunately, the product still works. And it has a very large market share in arthroscopy. But when you extend beyond that, make sure that there's solid, secure foundation behind it.
Well, let me ask it from this perspective, again, respecting what you can and cannot say. How much, of all the companies you've worked with, Arthur Kerr was the only public company. Correct. How much do you think Arthur Kerr, what happened to Arthur Kerr from your perspective, came about because of its status as a public company rather than a small private company? Say DVI was sold, Cevis eventually was sold. You probably have similar kinds of hopes for Vitronis, unless you want to make that a standalone company. But Arthur Kerr, because it was a public company, had mandates and kind of shareholder pressures that a small company doesn't have. How much do you think it has to do with being a public company?
I think a great deal, because public company, I think one thing I could say is that it had people had very large short position in Arthur Kerr. And the only way, nobody wins this battle with the shorts. But the only way to do that is increase the earnings. Mm-hmm. That your company is on a growth track and earnings are steadily increasing. So people start looking at creative ways of increasing earning. And I think that's where had it not been a public company, would have been, those pressures would not be there.
So you retired this time for 3 years. That's longer than you spent at DVI.
Yeah, I keep trying to retire, but it hasn't worked yet.
And then you actually went to work. You mentioned that Annette Campbell-White was an early investor.
Correct.
In Arthur Kerr. You went to work actually for Med Ventures, for Annette at Med Ventures. Talk about your experience as a venture capitalist, because it clearly wasn't a happy one.
Well, yeah, in many ways. In 2001, actually, in February, I decided maybe I should try being a venture capitalist. I see them around, they don't know.
Looks like an easy job. You don't have to work very hard.
Yeah. Nothing to it.
Just say no
just
a lot.
Write a check and say no a lot. So I joined MedVenture Associates at that time, and Annette was in the middle of raising the next round. And the notion of going on the roadshow and make certain promises and ask for money for future promises of return, that was not in my psyche. And I began to wonder about the whole process. And honest, I liked every idea because I could see how it could be made to work.
You're an entrepreneur's dream. You didn't invest in anything.
And then I rely on this, I've said it before, this ham and egg breakfast. You know, this is chicken is involved, but the pig is committed. So I wanted to be a pig instead of the chicken. The VCs are involved and not directly committed in many ways. So I left being a VC, and then I actually then joined a board of a company which was developing a product for atrial fibrillation, Epicor. And Dave Gallup, one of our co-founders of Vitronis, was there. And Dave and I go back, actually, to early oximetrics days. It was a very intriguing product, but it was from external surgical device. And then when I left the board, Dave and I got together and we said, there's still a need to do something about
Well, before we get to Vitronis, had an interim effort. Again, one of the ones that didn't work out in wound healing.
That's correct.
To talk about that company.
It was called Tessient. It was Tissue Engineering Science Org, a fancy name. And you've got to have a couple of capital letters in the name somewhere. We had all the mm-hmm. all that. This was a brilliant scientist out of UCSF, and he had isolated a peptide, a 15 amino acid piece from a collagen molecule. And his theory was that this is where the cells bind and they move around and use it like a ladder and scaffold. And there, in fact, there is a product on the market based on that for periodontal repair. So we quickly raised $6.5 million and proceeded to make this formulation for, among other applications, was wound healing, incontinence, urinary incontinence, to bulk up the tissue, really. And we did 4 animal experiments, where the experiment is pretty simple. On the back of the animal, you make a cut, 2 cuts, and you put formulation in one of them, leave the other one alone, and see how it heals. And we found that the nature's healing was better than ours. Our formulation wasn't really working. And Jim Swick here from Lycron was very helpful in that program. But I'm not blaming it on him. It was just... just Mother Nature.
So that technology didn't work, but after you'd raised $6.5 million, but after spending only $2 million, you decided to shut the
correct.
Company down. Do you think your perspective? I know you were only at MedVentures for, you know, less than a year, but do you think, notwithstanding the fact that it wasn't really what you wanted to do, did your perspective or your view of venture capital or of the entrepreneurial process change as a result of those 9 to 10 months as a venture capitalist?
Yeah, you develop intense respect for other people's money. You know, mm-hmm. It's when after 4 tries something is not working, it's no point going forward. So the best thing was to return the remaining money back to the investors, and that's what we did at Tessian. So we returned 60% of the money, and amazingly everybody was pretty thankful. They thought they would beat me up for wasting 40%.
So talk about Vitronis. Where you said you were on the board of an AFib company. Your current project right now is an AFib company.
Right.
Talk about how Vitronis got started. Who are the founders? You've raised $10.5 million. What is Vitronis going to do?
Yeah, Vitronis is a catheter-based attempt to deal with the problem of AFib. So we go in the atrium, and you need some way to block this weirdo signal, which confuses the atrium, and it fibrillates. So that's what we are doing. The founding came about when Dave and I got together, then Jim Aronson, he joined us, and then we said, we got to have some real person with credibility here. So we went to Paul, and Paul is also a co-founder of Vitronis. So 4 of us got together, we raised some money, most of it from NEA and some from Delphi, and then proceeded to do some work. It's at this stage, like everything else, it works. But pretty soon, when we go forward, the reality will set in. And Dr. Uday Kumar here, he keeps us honest and straight. And there's no way getting around him. I've tried, but.
How far away do you think Vitronis is from proving the proof of concept in the technology?
It at this stage, it seems like it's working in animals, which happens with every company. So this is not a big deal. But going forward, as we now do chronic studies and then on out into human, that's where the real test is. Over the next couple of years, we'll find out.
Several of the technologies that you worked on very early, I'm thinking of IVUS and atherectomy, are technologies that sounded very intriguing, proved themselves in the lab, but had early adoption problems, and more recently have found wider acceptance. I'm thinking of Fox Hollow and Pathway and atherectomy and Volcano and IVUS. Volcano, whatever you want to say about IVUS, is doing extremely well right now, all on the bed of IVUS. As you now look back on those early technologies, your involvement, and where they are today, what are your thoughts, what are your reflections on what it takes to evolve a technology into clinical practice?
It's a tough call, and I think luck has a big element in it. It's not, nobody has that vision that, okay, this technology is going to, except some people. Tom is here, Dr. Fogarty. But with that exception, it's very hard to tell ahead of time. You just go into it with good faith, hard work, and it might work.
Do you feel vindicated when you look at, again, Volcano is doing extremely well right now. Fox Hollow had a tremendous mm-hmm. success pathway is doing well, all kind of validating atherectomy and IVUS, which some people might have said in the 90s were kind of modern technologies.
Well, the feeling of validation is there, but there was not the motivation I went to. It was some fun thing to do, something new to do, and ultimately the patients would be helped. And then later on, I learned that you got to bring some return to the investors too. So it came together. It is satisfying, but I was incredibly lucky, I must say.
Well, what about atrial fibrillation? Because that's another field that has had a lot of technologies, a lot of adoption issues. Do you see the issues similar to atherectomy and IVUS, or do you think atrial fibrillation is a different kind of technology in terms of getting clinical adoption, clinical acceptance, and commercial success?
AFib is a big problem. There are about 2.5 million people here in US and 200,000 coming in every year as we grow older. So something needs to be done. And there is currently based, mostly it's RF based. There are a few other energy sources there. So somebody has to put a product out there. So it's a huge opportunity. And patients need help. And I believe the approach we have has a good chance of success. But the marketplace is brutal many times. But ultimately, a good clinical product comes through. It takes time, but it eventually prevails.
Well, I know it may be hard for you to assess right now, but what do you think the trajectory of Vitronis is going to be? We've seen atrial fibrillation actually kind of get a boost up in the last, just in the last 6 months. Bioscience Webster got a positive regulatory decision. Ablation Frontiers just got a nice acquisition deal with Medtronic. It looks like for once that atrial fibrillation is actually turning some kind of corner in terms of its return to investors.
Yeah, I believe it's going to be big. It's a problem that needs to be dealt with. The drugs don't work. There's really nothing else on the horizon. So it has to be a device-based treatment. Right now, the mechanism of AFib is not completely understood, but over time, it'll happen. Mm-hmm. So again, you know, it's just work hard and do things methodically, and something might happen.
We're right up against our end. We've got the reception coming up in a couple minutes. If there are any questions for the floor, if you could make your way to the microphone, and so we get these things recorded on tape.
Just had a little thing about those patents.
Sure. Oh, that's right, the patents.
Yeah.
On Arthrocare.
Right. So you folks might notice that Arthrocare has like almost 200 patents. So we decided early on to make sure that the wall is secure. And very early on when we started filing these patents, certainly I noticed that my co-inventor, Phil Eggers, his name came first and mine was second. So one day I asked Phil, I said, Phil, how come your name comes first? Phil Eggers, and I'm Thup Liao. He said, oh, it's in alphabetical order. He said that with a straight face. So I came home that night and I talked with my wife. And now we have two kids. And like all parents, we think ours are pretty smart. And who knows, one day they might get a patent or two on their name. So he said, you know, honey, I think we might want to change their name. So she says, what do you have in mind? I said, how about AAPLIY? So they're guaranteed first authorship. Then our patents issued, and one of the big competitors introduced a product, and we had to file a lawsuit. And Phil got very busy. Practice sessions and training sessions and all the depositions and court appearances and examinations and re-exam and everything else. And poor guy was working hard. So I noticed that, and I then another night came home and I said to my wife, I said, honey, remember that name change thing we were talking about? She said, what do you mean? We're not going to change? I said, yeah, we're going to change it all right, but it'll be Zup Liao with the Z. So that's the patent thing there.
Well, let me ask one final question. With DVI and CVIS, and particularly in your collaborations with Paul and John Simpson, you were right at the birth of arguably the modern interventional cardiology industry or you know, clinical segment. What's different today? How will Vitronics be different than DVI or CVIS, to your mind, in terms of launching and running and making a success of the company? Does it feel like a different environment today than it did 20 years ago?
In many ways, it doesn't really. The basic formula, if you will, or methodology remains the same. Yeah. But it's different environment now that the proof of concept, the clinical feasibility, you have to take the company far enough out there, at least several hundred patients. And Dave Gallup here is fond of saying that you really don't have a product until you have used it in 1,000 patients. That's really true. And I feel that we'll see more and more of that kind of requirement before Vitronis or anybody else is deemed successful.
Well, great. Well, it's a fascinating story. Like I say, it takes us right back to the roots of, I think, what so much of us do here in interventional cardiology. It's been a great story, and wish you great luck on Vitronis. I can't imagine that you won't be successful.
Oh, well, at least one person has the confidence. That's good.
Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you, David.
And I think the reception is now open in the back, so join us during the reception.
Any questions, anybody?
There didn't seem to be any, so.
I didn't realize I'd be so clear.
You were okay. Precise as could be.
Okay, Paul. Thanks.